60 Hertz.
Hello and welcome to Anger Management. My name is Georg Dietz.
I'm Karin Pettersson.
And as usual, we're here to argue with each other, actually. If Karin is finishing her... She's doing something with the computer, actually. But we, as usual, we talk about the future of democracy with the people that we think are on the forefront of ideas. And this week... For Karin?
Yes, big week.
Big week.
Big week. We talked to economist, political economist, world-leading thinker.
That's what you...
We tend to overuse that phrase, perhaps, but in this case, it's actually true.
It's all world-leading thinkers,
yes, so
basically.
Anyway, we met with Daron Acemoğlu.
Yeah.
He's a economist at MIT, professor, expert.
And a true superstar.
True superstar, yeah. Beloved by his peers, and also has written a blockbuster book called Why Nations Fail that many of you, I'm sure, have read.
Yeah, that came out in 2012, and then he started a Tumblr that made him even more popular.
Because he was funny. Economists are almost never funny.
Yeah, so he is funny, he is smart. People warned us that he's... One of the most intelligent people on Earth.
Yeah, but we were not faced by that.
As usually, we weren't faced by that. And also, as is so often the case with intelligent people, I think they're just also super nice.
Yeah. Super nice.
So he was very, very friendly. He had an hour in his office at MIT overlooking the Charles River, which was epic at that beautiful morning.
Yes.
But the really interesting thing that you pointed out afterwards was... They are lefties.
They are all lefties now. And even the people who you think when you read their books and their papers that they are very mainstream or maybe leaning liberal in a European usage of the word, when you talk to them in depth, they are more or less social democrats. Aren't they all, Georg?
Yeah.
Just like me.
Well, we had the discussion, as usual, with Acemoğlu. But he said he... regretted not being for Bernie Sanders, while not sort of being more clearly for Bernie Sanders, while acknowledging.
No, he said maybe it was a mistake.
Yeah.
To be fair.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how that sort of plays out for the audience in the podcast. I think it was really interesting to hear him talk about the sense of urgency that he has, so really, really afraid about the moment.
Yeah, and comparing with the more positive tone and outlook he had in the book from 2012, it's a big change in kind of how he describes the world, I think. This discussion we had with him this week and how a more optimistic take on things from a few years back. And
yeah.
I also want to thank listeners of this podcast who have... sent in questions, suggested questions via Twitter.
You can always tweet us at AB_Karin.
Yeah.
Or Georg Dietz 1. Who's zero? Who's Georg Dietz 0, actually?
So please send in questions. And we used several of your questions. They were really good. So thank you for that interaction.
Yes, and with that...
With that?
I think...
take it away.
Yeah. Good morning.
Thank you, Georg.
On this
Thank you.
Beautiful morning.
Thank you,
thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's... I think it's a special time for journalists and for economists and for people in the public field to think about democracy. That's what we do here in this podcast. And I'm wondering, at the beginning, somehow, you're the Tumblr... activities seem to have stopped. What's happening?
Well, you know, I started writing a little more on like foreign policy and places like that I wrote an article for foreign policy before the election, and then I followed up with another one after the election, and then I did a few radio shows, partly because I was very worried about the direction that this country is going. And of course, the direction that the world is going is not necessarily better, but this country is really the is a sore spot for the future of democracy, really. But then I found that it's so all-consuming that I took a little bit of time off, and now I'm working on some other things. But you know, you have to juggle the academic and sort of the public sort of exposition of both academic research and political issues. But I think these are also times that everybody needs to speak out.
Could you explain, in a way, I mean, you're an economist of great achievement, but you're a public intellectual since the last few years, it seems, since the book, when How Nations
Fail
came out.
Well, I think, I don't know whether public intellectual is a good word or a bad word. So, but
it's a good word. It's a good word.
Okay, all right.
In the European context, it's a good word.
Yeah, I think it's a very complicated thing because, you know, as academics, our first obligation is to do the research and the teaching, and I think that's what we are here for. But at some point, I think it also becomes a necessity, an obligation to sort of expose these things for a wider world, and especially when there are urgent issues that the public cares or should care about. I think it's important for academics to speak out about it. And the balance here is you have to do it either on the basis of the research so that you really are bringing some sort of expertise that others don't have and that you do have. Or, you know, it should be fairly clear that you are doing so as a private citizen. And I think that balance is a difficult one. And I think in the current context, it's a difficult one for me also, because I think when I see what's going on in the U.S., and I see what's going on to some degree also in the U.K., although much less, you know, that there's a large component of that that makes me very worried from the academic research I've done, but also I feel angered and frustrated as a private citizen. So that's that balance is the difficult one.
What is it then from your not as much as a private citizen, but from your research that worries you? Maybe going back to the theme of your book also, mm-hmm. and if I read it correctly, the thesis is that in the long run, tyranny will not prevail.
No, I wouldn't say
that. Even though
the
argument is more complex, is that not...
No, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think I'm a hopeful person, so the book is written with the hope that tyranny will not prevail. But there isn't anything in the book that says there isn't the possibility that extractive institutions, tyranny, dictatorship, repression will not prevail. It's... You know, the book's main thesis is about the importance of institutions for economic performance. But really, the center stage is about this interaction between economic and political institutions. And those interactions really bring their own logic to what can survive. So you can have, you know, terrible regimes like North Korea, you know, like, you know, Mugabe's regime in Zimbabwe, or you know Museveni's regime in Uganda, they have enormous staying power, and it's not even the case that, as we've seen with Chavez, you know, the charismatic leader dies and then the regime collapses. So there is a lot of persistence, endurance in these regimes because they have their own logic. They are enriching a group of people who are then willing to use force and all of their resources for the continuation of their regime. And so I think even though we can be hopeful about challenges to these regimes, we have to be constantly worried about these institutional paths taking us more and more in the direction away from democracy and towards personal rule, towards the rule by a small group of people that's kleptocratically sort of robbing the country and repressing other people. And we're seeing a lot of that around us. And I think what really makes me worried about the United States is that, you know, you have a country that, you know, for better or worse, has, you know, has been on the side of democracy, at least especially over the last 20, 30 years, and has built a complex of institutions that are fairly respectful of free speech and minorities and the rights of citizens in general, but it's also quite a fragile balance, and you now have probably the greatest challenge to these institutions the biggest danger that I can see any time on the 20th century, really. So.
And what is the threat? Is it kleptocracy or is it the rule of the?
No, I think it's much more than kleptocracy. I think
demolishing of institutions.
Exactly,
yeah.
It's the demolishing of institutions and it's demolishing of the social norms that that surround these institutions. I think, you know, corrupt politicians are terrible. They really also destroy the fabric of institutions. But, you know, U.S. has had, you know, corrupt politicians at pretty high places in the past, not in the presidency, in the sort of financial corruption. But, you know, with Nixon, it had a president willing to, you know, do illegal things for his own benefit. But it has never had this sort of onslaught against the nature of institutions. So that's why I see Trump as much, much more dangerous than Nixon.
Could we reflect on that sort of mindset maybe? Because I think, first of all, I think the work that you do is so interesting for someone like me because it combines the economic foundations with the very concrete political sort of implications and statements. But the mindset, I think, is interesting to see how you approached why nations fail, which is also not called how nations succeed, by the way. So that's kind of interesting maybe to think about this situation. But so what happened between, I guess you started the book in 2009, 10, or thinking about that? Was that connected to the financial crisis then, sort of at that point? Or but it's more about optimism.
I wish I could have such a nice story. No, actually, we planned the book in 2005. It just took us 3 years to get started.
But there's an optimism in the book, and there's a confidence in the book that this is in a way how economic growth and stability will prevail.
Yeah.
And you wrote a few papers actually in recent years of correcting some of the assumptions in the book,
yeah,
which is interesting. So could you reflect on that to see where your urgency comes from now, so of where you come from as a...
Well, I mean, I think the book is limited in what it tries to do. We didn't try to sort of write everything, and then there are important things that we left out. I'll mention a few of them that are not perhaps exactly what you're driving at, but we were quite conscious in doing so. I mean, I think the most important one, which I think has become probably a little bit more important since we wrote the book, is international relations. Mm. You know, obviously institutions are influenced by how different nations are interacting in the international sphere. The other thing that we sort of didn't really delve so much into were all these social norms and sort of the informal part of the institutions that make democracy work. I think that's very important, and we just did not have the space to go into it.
But things like trust.
Trust and respect,
yeah,
for the opposite point of view. Mm. You know, I've always thought that, you know, that's a centrally, critically important thing, that to make something like democracy, which is a very complex sort of political arrangement, mm, work, you need to have the forums and the disposition by people to listen to opposite points of view, and then sort of they may or may not change their mind. You don't need to change your mind, but at least you need to be able to give that forum to people and be able to listen to them. And again, that's part of the social norms. And then we're seeing that, for example, being eroded. So that actually brings me to the most important thing, that in some sense the book was a book of its times. You know, the world was, witnessing in the 2000s, and to some degree also in the 1990s, a very strong march of democracy. You had a flourishing of democracies in many parts of the world. Africa had, for the first time, the emergence of, you know, stable, functioning democracies. You know, there were a few like Mauritius and Botswana, but, you know, you had 10 essentially functioning democracies by the middle of the 2000s. You had the Arab Spring breakout, as we just finished the book. So, in fact, the preface of the book, which was written fully after the book was written, was sort of a reaction to the Arab Spring. You had the United States elect an African-American president. And I think that's, you know, a small symbolism, but it's an important symbolism. But as important you know, was the sort of the program that Obama stood for, which again wasn't perfect, but really reflected some of the concerns about, you know, how to make modern institutions, the modern economy, more sort of fair, more inclusive. So all of these, you know, gave us a euphoria, perhaps unwittingly made us sound more like that tyranny cannot prevail. But I think there really isn't sort of, it's not, our theory is not one where there is an ultimate institution that everybody is going to converge to, everybody's going to be democratic, everybody is going to be inclusive. I wish the world
was like
that.
Still, what happens? So is it, I mean, was it built on false premises, this democratic illusion of 50, is it only 15 years, basically, that we talk about? It's a very
I don't think so. I think...
And I think sort of the shock is now sort of to see, or to understand why that fragility of democracies and how can it, even this country, how fast can it turn from, I mean, all of a sudden Russians are in the sort of Oval Office all the time, and Assad is a partner, and the Turkish security guards beat up Kurdish protesters.
That was happening even before Trump, unfortunately.
Mm. Yeah, but so if you feel that this is a playground for authoritarians all of a sudden here, and this sort of resonates obviously in the rest of the world.
Let me try to give my imperfect answer to that. I think there are three huge problems for democracy in our modern day. One, I think, is a perennial problem, and we discuss it to some degree in the book, which is that, you know, democracy is about a particular distribution of political power and a particular way of resolving conflicts, and there will always be powerful people who are against it because they're not having as much voice as they would like. They're not able to use their economic power in the way that they would desire, and they have the means to subvert democracy, and we've seen that many times. We've seen coups against democracy. You know, some of those coups have entirely different sources, but you see the pattern, and we discussed that to some degree. The second is something that I hadn't really thought about before the recent events, and I don't necessarily have a very good way of conceptualizing it, understanding it yet, but I think it's real, and that's where sort of the journalism comes in. And I think you know, democracy has a soft spot, soft underbelly that hadn't been apparent before, and it is that a autocratic politician can undermine the institutions of democracy with the help of the media. Mm. And I think, you know, the way that we always thought in the book, and I think many people before, is, you have democratic institutions, and somebody may try to distort these democratic institutions, but then some sort of civil society participation, media, etc., will bring this out.
Yeah.
Will, and then that check will motivate people to say, no, stop it. And that's the story, for example, we told how it happened in the US when FDR tried to sort of pack the court, and why it didn't happen in Argentina, etc. But what this sort of understated in some sense is how low information most voters are. And then we thought, well, they are low information, but that's where the media comes in, and then it can raise the red flags and say, look what the president is doing. But of course, there's the opposite. They are so low information that, and this is where my concern with what's going on with journalism, media outlets and individual journalists, who are unscrupulous about the ethics of journalism and the ethics of democracy, can do exactly the opposite. They can lie, and they can say, look, the president or the prime minister is passing a decree in order to save you, while at the same time jailing people. And we've seen that play out in Russia. We've seen that play out in Venezuela. And perhaps most sort of starkly, we've seen that play out in Turkey. You know, there are so many parallels between, Erdogan's sort of strategy and Trump's that really gives me sort of great fright. You know, Erdogan, from the very early stages, understood that he could only rule by having his sort of media trolls. And that was a very, very conscious strategy from the early stages. And it really sort of created so much disinformation in Turkey that it made sort of the basics of democracy very difficult to function.
Can I just stay...
Right. I have a third point.
Yeah, I know you have a third point. Can I just stay on this point for briefly? Because we're obviously very interested in this. And I'm... So the way I'm thinking about this moment in terms of how this new, you can almost say, information infrastructure affects democracy or interplays with democracy is that I would argue that we have undervalued the... Or we haven't taken into account how different this world is now in terms of how people access information and how kind of easy it is to distort and use propaganda and because of the internet and how it's been moving from open to closed and these platform companies are monopolizing things and it's easy for governments and parties and actors to use this in their favor. But I'm also wondering about, in the U.S. case, it's not only that there is a supply of this information, there's also
a demand for this information.
Right,
it's the same in Turkey, yeah.
Yeah, so, and what is that demand? Is that connected to inequality? Is it lack of education?
That's exactly my third point.
Okay.
That's going to come. But I think there's always a demand. That demand is always there.
Yeah.
I think the demand has become stronger because of this third point that I'm going to make, but that demand is always there. And I think responsible journalism was sort of trying to resist totally giving in to that demand. Mm. And, you know, but, you know, I don't want to paint a picture of sort of idyllic journalism before the 2000s. I mean, if you look at the UK, for example, which I think has one of the best traditions of independent journalism, you also have the tabloids. And the tabloids, you know, the Daily Mail and the Daily Star always, you know, cater to that demand.
Sure.
Exactly. But somehow, or the News of the World, even worse, but somehow there was a hierarchy that it was sort of understood by a significant fraction of the population that you sort of read those things sometimes for entertainment, but, you know, you really didn't trust them as much as the BBC or, you know, the Independent, the Guardian or the Times or something like that. And I think that hierarchy has sort of collapsed. And I'm not decrying that. I mean, it's good that you have open entry into journalism. You know, you can't... I mean, but on the other hand, there is a sort of a... There's an asymmetry here. Like, you know, when you go to the doctor, you know, you're going there to get medical advice because the doctor has an expertise. You're placing your trust in his or her medical knowledge. And then there's also an ethical dimension. You know, the doctor takes the Hippocratic oath, and if it behaves in a sort of an unethical way, you know, distorts the information, tries to manipulate you, etc., he can lose his license. And I think most people are pretty happy with that. I mean, you know, we sometimes say, oh, well, there's too many licensing requirements, etc. But it's a good thing that there is this sort of regulation on doctors, but not on journalists. And, you know, we can't, you know, if you started telling total lies and manipulating people, we can't take your license away and say, no, from now on, you're not going to speak. And I can see why that's, we wouldn't want to do that, but it also creates this real sort of marketplace for disinformation, and as the resources that can benefit from that disinformation increase, I think it really is creating a chaotic environment that I don't actually know how we're going to fully resolve. But coming to the third leg of this, and this is what, you know, what I tried to write essentially in this foreign policy article before the election, which was written with the full certainty that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And the point that I was trying to make in the article is that there are real grievances, and that a democratic presidency, Hillary Clinton's presidency is not really on a path to sort of tackle and recognize these grievances. And I see two major grievances, and I think they are rather international, global in nature, meaning that we're seeing them in the UK, we're seeing them in France, we're certainly seeing them in the United States. And those two grievances come together in a very dangerous, nauseous potion for the future of democracy. The first one is economic in nature, that we've had enormous progress in terms of technological change and enormous advances in terms of globalizing the world economy, which has great promise for both the less developed countries that now have access to Western markets, and for Western countries to be able to sort of form more complex production supply chains. But we have not recognized, and we have essentially being asleep at the wheel in seeing that this process doesn't benefit everybody, and it has brought a lot of displacement, a lot of hardship for millions of people in the United States, in the UK, in France, in other parts of Europe. And both experts and like economists, politicians, journalists, we've essentially taken the attitude, well, these are good things, and everybody will benefit from them. You know, just be patient and don't sort of worry about it, and don't try to get involved in things that you don't want. you're not an expert in. But at the same time, you know, probably 5 million jobs over the last 20 years in the U.S. As a result of this process of automation, robots, trade have been lost in manufacturing, probably a couple of million in the U.K. So, and we've really not taken any actions to retrain these people, reintegrate them into the labor force, and even worse, you know, in the U.S., as opposed to Scandinavia and to some degree in Germany, we also don't have the social safety net to provide these people with a decent living standards after they have been hit with this, you know, pretty dire hardship. So that has really created a whole segment of society that's discontented and that sees technology, elites, you know, urban middle classes sort of thrive while they themselves are falling behind and have rightly been.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Sort of brewing a huge degree of anger and discontent. And that, I think that's the sort of the one leg of this. But then there's a second leg, which is sort of an uglier leg, and I think it's the two coming together that's really creating this sort of dangerous mix. And that second ugly leg is that at the same time, and this is sort of a gift of democracy in some sense, we've also been tearing down a lot of the hidden implicit inequities in society. You know, if you look at even as late as the 1980s or 1970s, in the U.S., in the U.K., there is a clear social hierarchy with white middle-aged men at the top and minorities very much at the bottom, much more silent, much less assertive, women, younger people. And that hierarchy has been sort of being torn down by the forces of democracy, by the forces of technology, by the forces of globalization. And now you have the double whammy. You have these people who are economically losing, and they're also, their sort of social existence, their sense of sort of worth that has been defined by the social hierarchy. And it's an ugly social hierarchy. I'm not defending it.
Yeah.
But it's what had defined their sense of worth. That's also collapsed. So that really creates a hugely dangerous kind of confluence of two factors that build this anger. And I think Donald Trump somehow, despite the fact that I don't think he's a very smart man, he really sensed that. And even though he's neither poor nor, you know, somebody who's particularly suffered from the social hierarchy's demise, he really sensed that, and he really exploited that to a degree that was really, you know, artful.
So okay. I know that Karen is sort of hot here. So yeah. We're in the middle.
So you go first then.
I go first, yeah, because Karen will explain to both of us how social democracy will save the world in the end, I think. So that's what she's doing.
No.
But I'm more interested in the failure. And so I think the picture that you painted is so painfully true or vivid.
I
would like to dwell on.
I hope it's not true, but it is.
No, but the interesting part is, first of all, I thought in one of your papers you explained, I think it was a social mobility paper, so you go back to Tocqueville and you explain why there is a connection between the poor and the rich, why, and that sort of, you know, very clearly, I think, sort of resonates with what's happening in this country at the moment, and it's very inexplicable about why do people who are obviously sort of not profiting from the policies that are put forward, why do they still support them? But I think the most frustrating aspect for me at this moment, and I think Karen was sharing that, is as you say, the solution that's put forward, the candidate that we all wanted. Well, I would have voted for Clinton, but Sanders was the more progressive candidate.
Nobody cares.
But so as you say, so we're sleepwalking, like. Sleepwalking is the phrase that's the book that the Clark book about the First World War, by the way. So we're sleepwalking. Yeah. That's what we did.
Yeah.
And the only guy who comes up with and say, so the progressive answer is the reactionary answer, and that's the super frustrating point at the moment. So I'm kind of so Clinton, as you say, didn't have the answers to those two fundamental questions.
Yeah, I mean, frustrating. Trump has it either.
But he has an answer for a lot of people. So that's the demand side.
Well, I think what was really frustrating. I'm just, you know, guessing here, but I think what was really frustrating for people for the last 20 years wasn't that their problems weren't solved. Per se. I mean, that was, of course, is frustrating, but their problems weren't recognized. You know, look at Obama. I mean, I think it's as progressive a president as you can hope in the 21st century. And he did not even articulate these problems. You know, he sometimes talked about
economic
poverty,
problems, right?
But these problems of technology and globalization, destroying jobs, destroying communities. He did not articulate that, and he of course didn't articulate the social hierarchy point. Obviously not. And then I think it's a good thing that we don't articulate the social hierarchy point, but we still have to recognize the presence. So it was, these were like the forgotten masses in some sense. I think that's how they felt. And it's not, I don't know, perhaps they think that Trump has the answers, but I think the fact that he brought a rhetoric that elevates those concerns was quite important.
So,
you tell us.
No, I'm not going to tell you. I'm going to ask a question about a paper that you wrote. Why it's called Something Scandinavians.
Yes.
Why should we all be Scandinavians? Mm-hmm. And you discuss the balance between social safety net and the need for innovation to create growth that then will be possible to redistribute in the best of all worlds.
Yeah.
And the argument you're making is that we cannot all be Scandinavians because if we have those social security nets, then
I think what I would like to clarify, that I think that paper is you know, it's because it's written it was sort of for a more academic audience, it didn't really do the right clarification. I think one has to distinguish between social safety net at the bottom and sort of redistribution at the top. And I was really talking about the redistribution at the top.
Right.
I think that argument really does not speak to the social safety net at the bottom. And I think we can all be Scandinavians when it comes to the social safety net at the bottom.
Okay.
And I think there
so
is
this
really
is the this is the compromise.
It's the good news, right?
Yeah. So, but I think what I don't believe is that we can all limit inequality at the top, while at the same time also hope to have, you know, very strongly entrepreneurial cultures and Silicon Valleys and Route 128s and so on
right.
and so forth. And I think that's where the trade-off is. And I think you can do that when you're a small country because, you know, you're benefiting from the world technologies. But I think the problem for the U.S. is much harder. So that's why I think the U.S. really, I mean, and that paper was written in some sense as a reaction to the sort of the view that, well, we can all sort of just increase taxes on the top 1% and then
sure.
solve everything. No,
yeah.
I think the U.S. has a much more fundamental problem. The U.S. needs to increase taxes on the middle classes, and that's the thing that nobody is willing to say in the United States because it's a sure way of losing an election. But U.S. needs greater, you know, you can do savings. There are lots of inefficiencies. But you're going to go only so far with savings, and you really need to increase taxes on the middle classes. That's the only way that the U.S. can have a modern social safety net, which it sorely needs. And the view that you can just do that by taxing, you know, a few millionaires is just like a pipe dream.
So just to follow up, maybe not on that question, but on something you said before, and kind of this moment also, because we've been taking a lot of classes this year with political economists and trying to follow the post-election debate. And it seems to me that there is this moment of awakening where a lot of economists and political economists are saying, yes, we did not take into account the negative effects for many people of technological disruption and of global trade, and we should have done that.
Mm-hmm.
We should have been more aware of that. But so the thing I'm wondering about is, even if you do that, even if you get better at thinking about the people who are negatively affected and create social security net, you still have the issue of the collapse of identities, the collapse
yes.
of institutions in terms of how you feel where your place
yes.
is in society
yes.
and what's
and
you
that's
know.
A zero-sum game. You're not going to be able to get rid of
yeah.
that, but you can manage that. I think it's the confluence of the economic collapse
right.
and the social identity collapse that's, you know, that social hierarchical process with some you know, different at a different pace, but it's been going on for the last 150 years. So and that always creates some reactionary forces, and sometimes they explode. But I think that can be managed
yeah.
with the right institutions, with the right political party structures,
mm.
and so on and so forth. So it's really the two of them coming together that really created the major problem.
Because even in my country, which is you know, progressive and prosperous
mm-hmm.
and has great social security net in relative to other countries, we still have the third biggest party in parliament is
yeah.
you know, a right-wing populist
yes.
party, and they're now surging in the polls.
Yes.
Even though
yes.
you know, if you look at Sweden from the US, it seems to be, you know, you have all these things in place.
And I think, you know, that's where, I mean, you know, I don't know whether it's your view or Georg were caricaturizing your view. So I do agree with your caricaturizing view that social democracy is the solution. But I probably disagree that social democracy is easy.
Yeah.
And I think, again, there, Swedes have had it easy because it's such a homogeneous society.
Yes.
And I think,
sure.
you know, with the increase in immigration, you're really going to see the fault lines of social democracy.
Mm.
Because even in an enlightened country as Sweden, as you know, some of the taxes start paying for people who the taxpayers are not identifying with, then you're going to see all the strains that have really been so difficult to manage in the United States.
Mm.
The United States is not only the world's technology leader, which makes it really very difficult, but it's one of the most heterogeneous countries in the world,
yeah.
and it's one of the most rapidly changing countries, and that it's very difficult to have social democracy in a country like that. But I agree
mm.
with the view that the only way I see for the future of the United States as remaining a largely inclusive society is to become more social democratic.
Mm.
But it's very important that it really becomes social democratic and not socialist. And I think that's where I worried about Bernie Sanders, for
mm-hmm.
example, that Bernie Sanders, you know, had many parts of his plan that were so inconsistent that made me think, you know, is he a really a social democrat, but or is he going to be something like the Podemos in Spain?
So I'm curious about what you talked before, sort of how to tackle inequality. Mm-hmm. You said tax the middle class, mm-hmm. and sort of, I don't know, that doesn't seem to tackle the problem of the super rich and the oligarchy problem, but on a more fundamental level.
No, you of course have to tax the middle, the super rich. Yeah, also, but still, it's not gonna.
But the fundamental question still remains. I guess first of all, social democracy never tackles the question of redistribution of wealth. That's basically the reason they exist, to keep more or less power balances in place on the one hand, and the other question would be sort of. So that's one question more for Karin, sort of how when
I can ask my own questions.
Or how why is that socialist, sort of, all of a sudden, why is that a danger? So isn't that sort of what you say is necessary? So why would you be sort of wary of redistribution? The other question is how to tackle something that you described in the interview now, but also in your papers. So how do you reconcile sort of the huge productivity gains with no gains in jobs? So what's the
well,
so social
no,
democratic?
No, those are two very different questions. So let me try to sort of answer the two separately. The first one is, of course, the boundary between the area between socialism and social democracy is a gray zone. But I take it that the sort of the defining characteristic of social democracy for me is that complete acceptance of the market mechanism for allocating resources, supported by educational redistribution and regulatory institutions to make that process fairer, less inefficient, less distortionary, plus the sort of redistribution system in order to sort of make that access to the market sort of more acceptable. And whereas I think the sort of the defining sort of characteristics of socialism in some sense is to a large extent not a complete acceptance of the market processes, so much greater degree of the state or bureaucrats or others making decisions about how to allocate resources. And I think if you sort of look at Bernie Sanders' program and the economists, for example, who were around him, you would really not be comfortable that this is a social democratic program. You know, that's why I didn't support him at the time. In hindsight, perhaps that was a mistake, but that was my concern. Now, on the question of, you know, which is sort of linked, which is where we're going, you know, productivity and employment and jobs. Well, I guess the difficulty is, and this is now going to get more into the economics of it, is that we actually have productivity gains, but they're not huge either. So there's something that doesn't quite add up here also, that we are seeing all these amazing widgets. We're seeing this transformative globalization process. But at the end of the day, if you look at the productivity growth rates of the U.S. economy over the last 20 years, they're nowhere comparable to what the U.S. economy or France or Sweden experienced in the 50s, 60s. So in some sense, if that productivity growth was higher, there would be more jobs created because people would be get richer, they would want more services, they would want more goods of others. So we have this automation going on, it's displacing workers, it's increasing productivity, but it's not such an amazing process that it's also lifting all boats at the same time. So I think there are several reasons for that. One of them is again related to the social safety net, or broadly construed social safety net. We just don't have a workforce with the right sorts of skills in the United States and in much of the rest of the world to be able to work with these new technologies and to sort of thrive in the presence of these new technologies. So that's really holding us back.
And maybe make inventions themselves.
Make inventions themselves, absolutely. Right. That's very important. But we have the inventions coming up. It's not, the problem isn't, you know, If you look at robotics, I mean, you have just amazing innovations.
Yeah.
We have, you know, software, communication technologies, new services. We have amazing innovations. It's just more, it's like the next layer. It's the workers who are supposed to be working with them in manufacturing and services. It's these workers that are sort of lacking, and they're also not being able to relocate once they lose their jobs. And that's all related to this educational system, and the educational system in the United States is failing because we're just starving it of resources. And that's related to this broader social safety net issue. It's not just resources overall, by the way. I mean, elite schools get a lot of resources in the U.S. It's the sort of the bottom 50% of the students in the sort of public schools than in poorer neighborhoods that are lower income neighborhoods that are really being badly served by this system.
So, but that's the recipe for authoritarian rule, right? So you say in your papers
that
you need modernization and growth for inclusive institutions, meaning democracy, to thrive. So if you don't have growth, then what? So
yeah, absolutely. But it's a recipe.
But don't you have to change then the equation if you want to have democracy? I mean, the growth is your field, but so if democracy is, so just take out growth and put something else in.
That is not that easy. But let me say one other thing though. It's not. I want to just underline one thing. That's actually, to me, that's the one of the hardest challenges. Also, all of these are they are not necessarily paving the way to right-wing populism. They could be paving the way to any kind of outside movement that's going to repudiate the system. So in some sense, I see the forces that, you know, fuel Podemos in Spain not entirely different from the forces that have fueled the Tea Party or Trump in the United States. You know, if you look at, they are all complaining about globalization, bankers, unfair rules, the common man not getting his due, jobs.
But just to
not
make the point, one is racist, the other isn't. One is more or less democratic, the other is authoritarian. Just because that's an ongoing argument also with Karin. And I'm not sure how productive that is. I think where you're coming from, it's meant to be productive. But it's also kind of...
I find the nativism and the racism of the Trump movement much more nauseous.
But you find Podemos equally troubling, would say? Or is there a grain
for change?
Well,
I mean, first of all, I'm saying they come from the same place.
Yeah.
And they are both reactions to the system, and neither of them have workable solutions. And so whether one is more dangerous than
neither
the other, I think...
Neither does the center, it seems.
Neither does the center. That's true. Touché. Well, I mean, it isn't that... But there's a difference, right? It isn't that the center is totally devoid of ideas. I mean, I think there is some of that. But it's more that the center doesn't have the way of presenting these solutions in an acceptable manner. So I think, again, I disagree with Obama on many things, but several parts of Obama's economic policies, if they could have been implemented, would have helped in some of these things.
So,
and another Democratic president, hopefully when they come to power in 3.5 years' time, will probably be more aware of some of these problems, but will they be able to get these policies passed? And that's, again, related to the middle being squeezed from the left and the right, and that's why I think I'm putting the Podemos and Trump and the Brexit and Theresa May all as part of, you know, the existing system doesn't work, some more radical solutions category.
This is so interesting because I think this goes to a discussion that I'm partly having with myself and also with Georg this whole year about, and that I just hear the echoes in things that people kind of in the center left are saying, and the my question is, or what I'm conflicted about is essentially, did the center left have the right answer? Or no?
I mean, certainly but, not
because
the right
I hear you kind of going back and forth on, right. on this. You're saying, you know, the populist doesn't have the right answer if they had just followed the Obama policies, because they were actually pretty good compared to everything else. And yes, they were pretty good compared to everything else. But at the same time, we have to have a discussion now about the fact that they were not good enough.
So I think I think that's very important. So that's where I'm starting. I 100% agree with you, and I see that. My position is a little sort of squeezed in between. So we did not do the right thing. We did not recognize the problems in the 2000s. But again, I'm saying center-left. But I mean, I don't even want to call it center-left. You know, in Germany, it's, you know, Merkel's party is very much like a social democrat party at this point.
No.
Yeah.
No. No. What? No.
Touché.
No.
Touché.
What? Germany's economic policies are destructive for Europe. And
For Europe, yes.
Yes.
For Europe. That's
yes,
for
yes.
Europe.
I live come from Europe. Yeah.
For Germany, they're fine.
No. Please.
It's interior social democracy and exterior submission.
I like Merkel's liberal, you know, standing up for liberal values, but you can't give her a blank check on her economic policies just because of that. No.
But, okay.
Center
policies, let's say. That... I think that's the only hope of developing workable solutions to these formidable challenges. And what I'm saying is that even though they were asleep at the wheel, even though they were sleepwalking, whatever they were doing at the time, were even with all of those shortcomings, were still better than any alternatives that have been articulated by, you know, Podemos or Syriza, or, you know, Syriza now has become more of an establishment party, but at the early stages of Syriza, Trump or Brexit or Marine Le Pen. So we really have to challenge the center. We have to push the center even further, but the center is the only game in town at this point.
So we're sort of circling back to the beginning and also kind of towards the end. I'd like to...
We're out of time.
We're running out of time, but we still have a few minutes then. So my question is again sort of to the role of the economist in this field or the public intellectual. So you say basically Obama or the left, the progressive side, and that's sort of the lesson of this election, let go of basic economic arguments. They changed the field and were more interested in identity let go of economic arguments. So,
right. There's an argument which has been popular.
I shouldn't have said that.
But I want to just comment on it in the U.S., which has been, you know, the Democratic Party abandoned the working classes and started, you know, talking about liberal values. And I think that's totally wrong. I mean, of course, the Democratic Party had to do that.
Yeah.
That's its base, and that's the progress on which we depend.
Yeah, and that's,
you know,
it's not a trade-off, totally.
Yeah,
it's not one or the
it's
other.
Not
and
a
I think that's a very important point to
yeah.
say. So that's the argument after the election. No, we gay rights and transgender.
Yeah, we should abandon
it's not one or the other. But as you say, Obama really didn't tackle the question. That had to do with the economists that were part of his team. So how can you have a progressive economic agenda if sort of you pay $700 billion to the banks and you have Larry Summers on your side? So what's the failure of your profession in that sense, sort of to be engaging not only in the political arena, but having sort of just taking or just trying to figure out the right ways?
Well, I mean, I think to some degree the economics profession has been complacent, that we did not sort of tackle those major social issues in the way that we needed to tackle. But also, I think our models, our conceptual frameworks were not up to the task. You know, we started with very simple models of trade that didn't really fully realize the job sort of dislocations that they created. We had models of technological change that didn't fully come to grips with how automation and related processes can mean huge job losses. That's very much work in progress, you know. But I think the economics, perhaps for good reasons, is a conservative not economically right-wing, but conservative profession. So if you ask me, you know, give advice to a politician, and I have my own model, and I have, you know, work that has come from 35 years ago, I will normally go to the work that have come from 35 years ago, not my new model. But that's where we were at a time where the models that came, the knowledge that came from 35 years ago, not up to the task. And that's where our conservatism didn't really serve us very well. So we kept saying, oh, trade is going to be good. All technologies are good. But we did not really come to grips with... same thing on the financial crisis. You know, we didn't... you know, there are plenty of people who wrote down works that said, oh, you know, information asymmetries and arbitrage opportunities can be bad. But when it came to giving advice about, you know, regulating hedge funds, regulating mortgage-backed securities, etc., that didn't sort of make it into the headlines of the economic policy making. So I think that sort of says in the future we have to be more on the ball on these topics also. But it's just generally for, and that's why there is this distrust of elites. It's true for all experts, journalists included. You know, we were all sort of somewhat complacent about these issues, even though they were going on under our noses.
Yeah, we're taking... you're kicking the ball. You're kicking the ball back to us.
I'm sharing the blame.
But no reason for self-hate, I think.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. But again, this is the only game in town if we're going to try to solve these things. And I think especially for journalism and especially for experts. I mean, I think in these polarized times, it's so important to be able to... practice ethically your profession, you know, provide advice, provide information in an ethical manner. I think that's just, it's a more and more difficult thing because there are going to be more and more demands for charlatans to sort of say things that are going to help one group or another.
I think that's an appropriate place to end this conversation. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.